Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books and East European Studies podcast series. I am your host, Amanda Swain. Today, we'll be talking with Alan McDougall about his recent book, The People's Game, Football, State, and Society in East Germany, published by Cambridge University Press. In The People's Game, Alan McDougall looks at football from the top down and the bottom up, as a tool of the state, as forming regional identities in East Germany and in a reunified Germany, and as a popular pastime. For our listeners in the United States, I want to clarify that we are talking today about what the rest of the world calls football and we call soccer. So I'll make sure to try and say football and not soccer during the interview. I found this to be a very interesting book and a way of looking at really important questions about identity and relationship between citizens and state through the lens of sports. And I'm looking forward to talking to Alan today. So welcome to New Books in East European Studies, Alan.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're so welcome. And as a more detailed introduction, I wonder if you would tell us about how you became interested in studying the history of Eastern Europe.
Sure. Well, I think the beginning of that answer is that my father was a Spanish teacher. And so when I chose a language to study at school, I chose the opposite of my father. We had the options of Spanish or German. So I ended up studying German. And became very interested growing up in the 80s. You know, I was always someone who played a lot of sport and was very interested in, fascinated by, even then, by the sort of East German athletics dominance of the Olympics, which was, of course, widespread, universal in that decade. So, and for some reason, always had an emotional sort of investment in East Germany rather than West Germany for a bunch of different, I'm not even sure of the reasons for that. So that was really the beginning of it. And cultivated that university. And of course, at the time I was then kind of going into my graduate school in the sort of mid-90s, that was when the East German archives were opening up. And it was just a very exciting time to be a sort of a young scholar working in the field of East European studies, really.
Mm-hmm. So why did you choose sports as a lens through which to analyze the topics you're interested in? And tell us a bit about what seems to be a developing field in sports history and sports studies.
Well, I picked sport, I mean, it was partly a personal preference in that it was something I was very engaged in, both in scholarly sense, but in a non-scholarly sense. And I felt in terms of East Germany and perhaps more generally Eastern Europe that the kind of the narrative of sport under communism was very much focused on very much the sort of Cold War stereotypes of sort of automatons and state-sponsored doping. And I knew there were many more interesting narratives sort of beneath that. And football seemed to me the sport that encapsulated or showed the way to get to that greater complexity, first of all, I would say. And in terms of the wider field, well, that's a very interesting question. I think that sports history has, it's just a very interesting field. It places itself across a number of disciplines, which in some ways can be a strength, but also I think means that it doesn't really have a home. And from a historian's perspective, it seems to me a subject, if you compare it, for example, to another aspect of popular culture like cinema, to be underrepresented. So I guess there was a sort of a slightly proselytizing aspect to kind of making sports history a subject that the historians, not just of Eastern Europe, but historians generally should take increasingly seriously, which I do think is happening.
Mm-hmm. I'm encountering it more and more. So I was very interested to read your book because it's really the first full work I've read in this new field. And you tell the story of a taxi driver asking why you would bother writing a history of football since the sport was characterized by mediocrity compared to other sports in East Germany. As you mentioned, they dominated the Olympics in a number of sports, but certainly not football. So why football? What was it about football rather than, I don't know, weightlifting or some other sport?
Well, I think in the very mediocrity is the attraction in a way, because I remember that a couple of reviewers of early manuscripts, which were generally very supportive, also pointed out the same thing. You know, I wonder if there's a whole book in this. But I mean, the simple answer is that despite the East German obsession with Olympic sports like weightlifting, as you mentioned, or swimming or track and field, as in most European countries, most South American countries, and indeed most of the sort of non-North American world, you know, football was the most popular sport, both in terms of participation and spectatorship. And there wasn't really a study that kind of approached that sport in a holistic manner, I guess. And it was also a sport, and I guess this was what was the most interesting aspect when I initially took on the project, it was clearly a sport from the bits that I read and researched that the state struggled to control. In a way, it could control those Olympic sports more easily, whether it was through doping or talent spotting of young athletes or training programs, or just the fact that they were individual sports. Football, because it was a team sport, because it wasn't really important to the Olympics, particularly not in this period before 1989, and because it had a mass following, i.e. people invested their time in it as spectators as well as players, it just seemed to be an interesting way of, sort of contributing to very lively recent discussions in East German historiography, but from a under-discussed or maybe even undiscussed perspective.
So let's start with the description of the post-war reconstruction of mm-hmm. football. And at the time, it wasn't a political priority for the state, but really there was a grassroots drive to kind of reestablish football clubs. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting period. I mean, in some respects, it was the toughest aspect of the book to research because there was, East Germany generally has these huge archives. It was a very well-policed state. But the early period, which is period from 1945 to 49, you know, there's officially no East German state. We're still in the Soviet occupied zone. So in that period, there's just a great deal of political flux, obviously, in the beginning of the Cold War. And naturally enough, in the prevailing political and economic circumstances, sport was not given great investment, at least not until probably the late 1940s. That was when the ruling Communist Party, the SED, started to think more seriously about sport as a vehicle of sort of Cold War point scoring, possibly for mobilizing a sense of socialist identity. But in this early reconstructive period, priorities lay elsewhere. So as you mentioned, a lot of the drive to develop or rebuild sporting structures, particularly in football, came from the grassroots. And I think an aspect of the study that I tried to emphasize throughout was the ways in which agency came, even in a state dominated by a top-down apparatus like East Germany, even in that kind of state, in sport at least, and in other aspects of popular culture, I think there was a lot of grassroots agency in setting up organizations and making them successful.
So how then did the new East German state get involved in football, and what did they see as the role of football in establishing a new state and this new identity as East Germany?
I think that probably the short answer is they didn't see football playing a particularly important role. I say somewhere in the book, I think in the conclusion, that the SED tolerated football through gritted teeth. And there are some exceptions to that in terms of individuals, as we'll perhaps talk about later, who are very passionate about football. But I think the party leadership as a whole, was rooted in that sort of Marxist skepticism about sport as a kind of opiate of masses. And football is the worst representative of that in a way, in the sense that it was not only distracting to play, but it took, you know, people watched it in large numbers. It took away from more productive aspects of socialist production. So I think the SED initially, gave football a fair degree of leeway, but that does begin to change in the late 40s and early 50s, which is when the East German dictatorship really begins to take root. It's when East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, is founded in 1949. And from that point on, there are attempts to kind of bring football onto a more obviously communist model, for example, restructuring, relocating clubs, giving them more communist names associated with workplaces, bourgeois clubs. So that does begin in the 50s, but it's not really the SED's greatest priority, even in the field of sport. That tends to be, particularly later on, the Olympics, of course. And even when the SED does put emphasis on kind of reforming or restructuring football, it runs into lots of resistance. And of course, the SED itself is far from a monolithic entity. You know, there are regional and local differences, different organizations within and associated with the party. So, yeah, particularly in the 50s, I would say it's a pretty complicated and messy picture.
Mm-hmm. So in part one, you analyze the players, mm-hmm. and particularly the tensions of being paid to play sports in a socialist system. Yeah. So tell us about some of these sports figures and their relationship with the state and with society.
Well, I mean, this is a very interesting aspect, I think, of the study of not just East German sports stars, but Eastern European sports stars in this period particularly. Because on the one hand, they were, to use the very famous quote about East German athletes, I think diplomats in tracksuits, you know, they were, in East Germany's case, some of the most successful representatives of the state abroad, not so much in football, but in other sports. But they were also at the same time, often, you know, celebrities, you know, whether locally, regionally, or in the cases of the bigger players, nationally. And so for the state and the communist state, of course, with its emphasis on the collective and its kind of wariness of individualism and celebrity to some degree, the players often found themselves in quite difficult, well, you know, what could be quite tense positions, I guess. On the one hand, trying to manage the expectations of the state, which, you know, controlled football ultimately, but on the one hand, being quite privileged representatives of, for want of a better term, the people.
I thought it was interesting that you pointed out that particularly with football, that they're being paid to play the sport, but they weren't necessarily very good and this mediocrity. Yeah. And so, and that, you know, that also then affected the way that, you know, kind of people and fans viewed them, that they were privileged, yet they weren't fulfilling perhaps expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here we have a narrative that is transnational and also transcends different times and spaces. I mean, I think, you know, fans as paying customers have always complained about underachieving footballers. I mean, that's, or sports stars more generally, that's not confined to East Germany. I mean, I think it's brought into sharper relief in East Germany for a couple of reasons. One, of course, is that the state increasingly prioritizes and is successful in other sports, Olympic sports. So some members of the public see the success of an East German javelin thrower or swimmer and compare that to the relative lack of success of an East German footballer. Now, of course, we're not really comparing apples and apples here because the competitive field in international football was much wider, arguably, and it was a team sport, not an individual sport. But nonetheless, that was one factor, I think, in the public's mind. And the other one, of course, which we shouldn't forget, is that in contrast to the other East European communist regimes, East Germany always had that sort of big brother across the border, which from 1954 onwards was producing phenomenally successful football teams. And so there was always this alternative identity that threatened the East German football nation. And that was alarming both to supporters of East German football, of which there were many ordinary citizens, but also to the state, of course.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to come back to that relationship between West German and East German, mm-hmm. West German football and East German fans in a little bit. But to stick with this conversation about the East German teams and their competitiveness in the international realm, you subtitle the first section of your chapter on the national team, The Beautiful Losers.
That's right.
And certainly East German football did not achieve the international recognition that these other sports. So how much did East Germans care, either the state or the fans?
I think they cared a lot. The state cared because after the Olympics, football was the most important sport. Football, when the East German state restructured sport in the late 60s, and they essentially divided sports into elite sport, performance sport, into two tiers. And the top tier got more funding. And the second tier, which included sports like tennis and basketball, was kind of cut off. Football was included in tier one. So football is important. And they knew, of course, that it was the capitalist states that were generally doing well in the sport. So there are, you know, myriad reports from across the decades by the state and various bodies of the state lamenting the media, suggesting X or Y reasons why or how they could improve. And at the same time, you know, many ordinary citizens, it bothered them as well. I mean, questions of how loyal East Germans were to the state more generally is one thing. But I think certainly the football team, you know, which was made up, of course, of players from individual clubs, many of whom fans supported, the national team did excite or could engage the public. And when it didn't perform, which was quite often, you know, could anger the public too.
So even though they did care, as you said, about the national team, it was really the club teams at the local level that seemed to generate these really intense loyalties. So can you tell us about this kind of entrenched localism within football, both what the impact was within East German state and identity building, but also how this fits in more broadly with football clubs in the broader context of Europe?
Mm. Yeah, so in the East German context, I mean, it's interesting for a number of reasons. I mean, two of them, I suppose the first would be that the East German state, of course, was focused on creating a new socialist personality, a new socialist state in which collective identities based around a sort of an idealized socialist fatherland were emphasized. And so what the authorities rather scathingly called local patriotism in football or other activities was generally frowned upon. And any localized activities under communism were meant to be state directed and controlled and to ultimately reinforce the kind of socialist fatherland. So that was one reason why localism in football could be problematic, because it was an uncontrolled or only semi-controlled aspect of this sort of localism. And the other one, I suppose, is that East German football and the East German state was trying to distance itself from pre-war narratives. And if we go back to the pre-war period in football, of course, football, like other sports, was tarnished by the Nazi regime. Some of the most famous club names in German football had collaborated with the Nazis, as had the Football Association. And so I think there's also an attempt to kind of make a break with older local traditions. Now, that can be done in cosmetic ways, name changes and so on and so forth. But disrupting or uprooting the more deeper, longstanding local traditions, that the communists found that much, much more difficult. And in terms of the sort of second aspect of your question, I mean, even in sort of the very globalized, the sort of television-friendly commodity that football is today, now those local identities are still very important transnationally, because, you know, clubs generally are rooted in and have founded in one neighborhood in a community, within a city usually. So, I mean, one of the interesting aspects of the story of East German football that I try and emphasize is the ways in which this is part of a transnational story, that although East Germany is in many ways a kind of a strange, isolated state with this very distinctive history of sport that we all know about, the doping and the Olympics and so on and so forth, it was also, particularly in football, very much part of a transnational story in which local identities sort of reinforced themselves against outside impositions, whether it was an authoritarian state, whether it's commercialism, whether it was national teams. So in that sense, I think it's very important to the formation of East German state identity, but also tells us a lot about the fact that East German football is part of a transnational story.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that really stood out in your book, that both this very particular story of East German football, but also the ways in which it was similar or differed to, you know, the global story of football as a sport. But any book about the German Democratic Republic has to address the issue of the Stasi. So tell us about the relationship between football and the Stasi.
Well, football and the Stasi, the East German secret police, was a complicated relationship. There has been much literature on the Stasi in East German society. It's the single most fascinating aspect of the story in many respects. And of course, the success of films like The Lives of Others recently internationally has kind of only reinforced that sense of the Stasi's centrality to East German everyday life. And there's lots of scholarship on that too. I mean, I mean, the first thing to say, of course, is that the East German football at the elite level in particular, but also in terms of fan culture, increasingly in the 70s and 80s, was heavily policed by the secret police. The average level of informers in a football dressing room at a top division club was considerably higher than it would have been among the average of the population. So top referees, coaches, players, team doctors, fan club leaders, you know, all of those people were approached by the Stasi. Some of them worked for the Stasi, usually as the what were called unofficial informers or EMs. So at one level, the Stasi involvement in football is extensive and has a damaging effect. And I give some examples of that in the case of leading clubs like Dynamo Dresden, where the Stasi influence is particularly heavy. But I think what interested me the most was the fact that even in this heavily policed state, this sort of highly saturated surveillance state, football, like, you know, in some respects, like popular music, was a site that was, you know, as I use this phrase, this sort of liminal site where even the Stasi found it difficult to gain traction. Maybe that was less true in elite football, but certainly in fan culture and kind of lower down the food chain of football, the Stasi's influence was often quite patchy. And it just complicates the picture of the sort of all-pervasive and all-knowing state that we see in films like The Lives of Others, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk now about the fans, which is the topic of the second part of your book. And you say that socialist spectatorship was meant to reflect the character of the socialist system. But football in East Germany was characterized by spectator unrest and hooliganism from the 50s through the 80s. So what led to this violence, recognizing that that may have been different at different periods in time, and how did the authorities respond?
Well, again, I think, excuse me, I think in terms of the, you know, the violence in and around football stadia that becomes more pronounced in the 70s and 80s in East Germany, but as you mentioned, existed all the way back in the 50s. I mean, again, that is part of a transnational European and indeed, you know, global story of football spectatorship, particularly in the post-war period, particularly in the 70s and 80s when hooliganism becomes sort of the byword for international football, really, particularly in the English-speaking world. So in some respects, the East German narrative is part, again, of a global narrative. But at the same time, East German football and spectatorship becomes an indirect means of expressing dissent at various aspects of life in East Germany. I guess that would be the way to put it, which is not to say that violence or protests at football grounds were necessarily anti-state or anti-communist. It's certainly not to suggest that they were very often targeted to achieve a certain political goal. But nonetheless, the ways in which protests occurred, and violence occurred, suggests, proves, I would say, a very different image of the socialist state than the one, of course, that the regime liked to put forward in its kind of choreographed images of the young at kind of youth organization meetings or these big showpiece festivals that they began to organize in the late 50s. So, I mean, football is kind of like the underbelly, the kind of subcultures where there is autonomy or at least semi-autonomy, and in which we get to see that the picture is a lot more colorful and a lot more complex than we would, you know, perhaps in terms of Cold War stereotypes think.
Mm-hmm. And I was interested in your discussion that you've already referred to briefly of the subversive intersection of music and football and socialist popular culture. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's some interesting parallels. I mean, some of my previous work, I worked a little bit on the, my first book was on the Free German Youth, which was the communist youth organization in East Germany. And I was very interested when I was doing that research on kind of the way in which the Free German Youth tried desperately to kind of respond to the popular craze for the Beatles and other sort of Western bands in the 60s. And so there's some interesting parallels between football and music in the sense that both of them have their sort of global stars are based in the West. The kind of So they there's a sort of a cultural seepage across the Iron Curtain in both leisure pursuits. And they both have this scope for autonomy and freedom, I think, that makes the state anxious and that makes and that applies, I think, in particular to football spectatorship. Playing football is perhaps a slightly different aspect of it, but football spectatorship in particular was part of a subculture in which going to games, listening to music, you know, drinking with friends, getting free rides on trains across the Socialist Republic, all of these things were kind of bound up with a kind of, you know, a defiant youthful culture that's very different than the one that the state would like to see young people engaging in, I guess.
Right. And most of this was being engaged in by being physically present at these sport events. But the spread of television in East Germany resulted in what you call this mediated spectatorship. So what was the impact of this new way of engaging in sports and by watching it on television?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think one of the what makes football interesting, particularly interesting as a site for the sort of social and cultural history of East Germany is that it's both a very public activity, both playing and spectating. But increasingly, as you mentioned, as television becomes more prevalent in East Germany, it's also something that can be, like music, a private activity behind closed doors. So lots of the sort of most interesting elements in East German historiography have recently emphasized this sort of shift to more private spaces in East Germany, certainly in the 60s and 70s, which I think reflects, you know, wider shifts across the Soviet bloc in this period, and television plays a big role in this. And football on television certainly does. And I know from scholarship on football in the Soviet Union, something similar happens. It complicates the relationship between the state and society, because now there's this private sphere where people can, for example, watch West German teams on television and can kind of comport themselves with relative freedom, I guess. Picture, I would say.
And now to come back to West Germany, as you mentioned, you know, right across the border in the in this divided Germany, there is the West German national team, which was a football powerhouse. So how did East Germans feel about that? East German fans in particular, like, did they see that the West German team as in some ways their team? And then what did the state try to do about this this difference in capabilities, so to speak, of the two national teams?
Well, the state generally, and again, the Soviet football team tended to do the same, tried wherever possible to avoid, certainly in the 50s and 60s, playing too many of the world's leading teams, and certainly would have run very fast from a fixture against West Germany. Now, of course, the two teams meet very famously once in 1974, and they have to at the World Cup finals, and East Germany, again, very famously or infamously, depending on your perspective, win the game. But the state generally there's an inferiority complex in football, which I think reflects a sort of insecurity and inferiority complex that crosses into many other areas of East German life when measuring up against West Germany, whether it's car production, drinkable coffee, you know, nice jeans, good football teams. All of these are areas in which West Germany seems to be markedly superior than East Germany. So the state is on the defensive generally. In terms of the fans, well, the reactions are very interesting. And I interviewed a lot of fans for this project and talked to people off the record too. And there was a wide variety of responses. Some people supported the West German national team instead of the East German national team. Some people supported both the East and West German national teams. And some people supported the East German national team and didn't really like the West German national team because they kind of felt there was a sort of a Western arrogance about it, and that there was a sort of a rather patronizing attitude to the socialist neighbor, either patronizing or based on ignoring the socialist neighbor, of course. And that certainly upset some people. So, yeah, there wasn't really one single fan model, I would say. But what I would say is that most fans who loved football were international, as most football supporters are, and would watch games involving West Germany because West Germany was a very good team.
Mm-hmm. Well, where would sports history be without a good scandal or a crooked champion? So tell us about the Berlin Football Club and particularly the 1988 championship.
Well, Dynamo Berlin or Berliner FC Dynamo, BFC as their acronym would be, was essentially the football club of the secret police, the Stasi, who we've already talked about. The head of the Stasi, one of the most powerful men in East Germany, was Erich Mielke, long-standing communist, a man who actually his first love was ice hockey, but was also very much invested in this football team, Dynamo Berlin, which had kind of developed in the 50s and was renamed Berlin FC Dynamo in the mid-60s. And then from the late 70s until 1988, BFC wins the East German national championship for 10 straight seasons. So it dominates East German football. And I mean, what's interesting about this story is that, you know, from a kind of social and cultural perspective, is it causes uproar in the sort of East German football community and indeed beyond it, sort of particularly peaking in the mid 1980s when there are widespread accusations that the BFC are corrupt, that they're buying referees, that matches are fixed in advance. And so there's this, you know, a very visible campaign based primarily around what were called petitions to the authorities, letters of complaint, essentially, challenging BFC's dominance. And in terms of specific, well, there's the specific, I mean, I highlight a couple of specific games in the chapter I have that focuses particularly on this. The 1985 Cup final against Dynamo Dresden was probably the tipping point. Dynamo Dresden were BFC's main rivals. They were also sponsored by the police, but not the Stasi, so other organs within the police. And Dynamo Dresden, for various reasons, were a popular team. They were the best-supported team in East Germany. They had quite a lot of neutral supporters who liked them as a second team. So there was a big bitter rivalry between the two Dynamo teams. So they met in the cup final in 1985. Dresden won the match, but in very controversial circumstances that triggered a flood of complaints to the press, to the football association, to the party, and eventually kind of forced the authorities to make some changes in how football was governed, to punish referees, and to kind of try to put a lid on this anti-BFC protest, which you know, was particularly in a state as politicized as East Germany, you know, carried some dangerous elements for the communists.
Mm-hmm. So the book is titled The People's Game. Describe for us football as a part of everyday life in East Germany.
Well, I think one of the interesting aspects of football as an object of scholarly research is where the focus has always lain. And generally speaking, and returning to our sort of earlier question about sports history and the evolution of sports history, I think because sports history as a field or subfield of history evolved at quite a late stage, the initial sort of wave of that sports history was often quite institutional. So you'd be explaining how structures worked and kind of focusing on a top-down approach and the elites. And then, of course, the other aspect of football history in particular that fascinates people endlessly is hooliganism. We see that in the media, we see it in films, and we also see it among scholars. But the aspect of the story that I think goes underreported is precisely this element of the ways in which football intersects with, to use a term really from sort of 20th century German historiography, Alltagsgeschichte, or everyday history. And so the final sort of part, the third part of my book, I tried to look at the ways in which football shaped sort of daily routines and patterns. And so here I was interested in looking at sort of football away from fighting fans and, you know, the stars of the top division, and looking at facilities for ordinary fans, for ordinary players. Very interesting story of women's football in East Germany. and kind of recreational teams, essentially. And again, this was, tying this story into trying to understand what life looked like on the ground for ordinary East Germans, which I think is a harder task to do because the authorities were less interested in recording this. So we have lots more sort of archive football hooligans or underachieving East German footballers than we do on pub teams in X or Y town or village.
In the book's introduction, you present three interlinked arguments about football's significance in East Germany. And as we've already discussed, to some extent, football gave people a means of expressing identities that were separate from or even opposed to that endorsed by the state. So could you explain for us the term Eigensinn and the implications of these different identities that people held?
Yeah, sure. I will do my best to explain Eigensinn, though I think most scholars who've worked on that term probably couldn't explain it entirely, so I'm going to try my best. The term was originally coined by Alf Ludker, of course, one of the prominent historians of 20th century everyday German history, writing initially about the Nazi period. And Eigensinn, it's kind of, a more dictionary transition would be something like obstinacy, I think, or kind of stubbornness. And it was meant to denote initially kind of the response of workers in factories under the Wilhelmine and Nazi regimes, their response to kind of authoritarian bosses or kind of their interactions with authority and the ways in which factory workers distanced themselves from or created space from authority, essentially. And the term was then transposed to East German, the field of East German studies, when that became very big in the 1990s, and was kind of slightly reduced to kind of being vertical, that is to say, about distances between authority and ordinary people, so to speak. But there's also a sort of horizontal aspect to Eigensinn, which is the ways in which people create spaces from each other, you know. And football, I think, was a very interesting vehicle for sort of both this vertical and horizontal Eigensinn, the ways in which fans stubbornly, if you like, created, or players created, identities that were distinct from the socialist state, but also distinct from the neighboring village, the neighborhood on the other side of the city, or the rival club at the other end of East Germany. So it seemed to me an interesting way of sort of accessing a sort of football's fluidity and ambiguity as both a site of compliance with the state, because obviously football was very reliant on the state for funding, structures, and so on and so forth, but at the same time as a site of agency, whether that agency can be read as resistance, that raises a whole bunch of other questions. But I think Eigensinn's a profitable way of kind of getting into that discussion in terms of football.
Mm-hmm. And you just referred to what you speak of as a constrained autonomy, mm-hmm. in which these East German citizens lived, one that was shaped both by the tensions between this pressure for conformity, but also this obstinate forming of separate identities. So what was this environment, and how is football really revealing that, of this constrained autonomy?
Well, I think, there are almost two narratives of East German history. There's the one that is more popularly well known, which is based on, to take the most obvious tropes, massive Stasi surveillance, a deeply unpopular authoritarian state, East German medal machines with kind of semi-robotic, drugged, mostly women athletes kind of sweeping all before them at Olympics, all of which plays into that older view of East Germany as a totalitarian state in which individuals were kind of crushed beneath the collective will of socialism. So that's one of those narratives. And obviously, there are obviously elements within that story that remain true. We know that Stasi's famous of footballers we've been discussing was quite extensive, for example. But at the same time, and as scholars of East Germany, particularly those interested in everyday aspects of popular culture, have been emphasizing in the last 10, 20 years, there are other stories at play here as well. And the ways in which citizens created identities that existed, I would say, alongside more than against state pressures and state directives. And I think football is a great example of this. And in some ways, quite a unique example of this, because football was perhaps more than any other form of popular culture, it was popular, it was visible, it was played regularly. So there was a rhythm, there was a calendar, games happened all the time. It wasn't like the Olympics, and it was highly versatile. So it meant that it could serve both the state's interests at certain points, but also those of citizens who could invest in it the meaning or meanings they saw fit. And of course, that applies to authoritarian dictatorships across the world in different times. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your book, like a much recent scholarship, as you've mentioned, really is revealing the fractures in what had been perceived as this monolithic East German state. So how does football expose the limits and dysfunctionalities of the East German state and of the Communist Party's leadership?
Well, I think football does it in a number of ways. I mean, one level is transnationally, that football, because of the ways in which players and fans always have one eye on the West, and also I should emphasize sports officials do as well. You know, there's always this transnational element of, to use the phrase that's used in the historiography of cultural exchange here, that goes on despite the political enmity between East and West Germany. So that the kind of striving for a sort of socialist narrative is always undercut by the transnational elements at one level, the ways in which West German League, the Bundesliga on television, the ways in which they travel to Czechoslovakia or Romania to go and watch Bayern Munich, the leading West German team playing, for example, the ways in which players, in a small number of cases, leave East Germany for the West, the ways in which coaches demand contacts with coaches in leading football countries like the Netherlands or Italy or elsewhere. So there's this transnational element that undermines or complicates the story. But then there's also the local or regional aspects which complicate the attempts to create a really solid socialist national identity in East Germany. And to go back to the example I mentioned earlier of Dynamo Berlin versus Dynamo Dresden, the sort of most bitter rivals in East German football. I mean, that rivalry was rooted in a number of different aspects, but it had a deep-rooted historical rivalry between essentially Saxons and Prussians. Dresden was a major city in the region of Saxony, and of course, Berlin was the capital of the old Kingdom of Prussia. And so a lot of the sort of hate clubs, particularly their supporters, was based on, you know, Prussian versus Saxon pigs, to use the terms of insult that they would have used at each other.
So what role has football played in German reunification and in regional identity today among Germans in the East?
Well, that's a very interesting aspect of the story, I think, is that, you know, again, I think we tend, there's a certain narrative that we tend to think of with the end of East Germany and the collapse of East German sport. And again, the focus here is generally in that narrative on the exposure, the full exposure of the East German doping program, the kind of the obviously very sensational things that came to trial in some cases in terms of the revelations of the doping program. But a very interesting aspect of the story, I think, is what happens to football in East Germany after 1989 and 1990, because in contrast to Czechoslovakia or Poland, East German football loses all of its structures. They're not reconfigured into a sort of a new post-communist league. They are subsumed into the pre-existing West German structures, the Bundesliga, which by this point is one of Europe's most profitable leagues. So, I mean, this fits, of course, with wider narratives of a sort of annexation of the East that's felt in industry and other areas in the post-unification period. So I suppose the first thing to say is that football in East Germany after 1989 kind of falls off a cliff. Most of the teams struggle to compete in a capitalist environment. They're totally unprepared for it. Players depart for West Germany in large numbers. The clubs, either through financial incompetence or in some cases corruption, collapse or are relegated to the very lower divisions of East German football. East German football in this period in particular, it becomes a byword for hooliganism. There's a very violent subculture around many East German clubs, including the Dynamo Berlin, the big club of the 1980s. So on the one hand, this is a narrative of failure and decline. But on the other hand, there are aspects of the story that play into sort of almost a paradoxical reclaiming of a sort of East German identity that is stronger after the state collapses than during the state. So, you know, the odd East German teams that do well in the 90s, like Hansa Rostock or Energie Cottbus, become sort of markers of a posthumous East German, even socialist identity, funnily enough. So in that sense, football plays into what historians of East Germany have called Ostalgie, or sort of a nostalgia for the East, which is, of course, by no means confined to East Germany in the post-communist states in the 1990s. That's happening in other places too, as the kind of hard realities of life under free market capitalism kick in. So I think that's one interesting aspect of the story that we can certainly emphasize.
Well, I really enjoyed reading the book, and I learned a lot about the East German state and East German society by looking at your analysis of football. So I know that our listeners will also enjoy both this conversation and hopefully pick up a copy of the book to read. So thank you again for being here today. And I'd like to close with our standard final question, which is tell us about what you're working on now.
Well, I have a couple of projects sort of in the next 3 or 4 years, I guess. One is a football history, a social and cultural history of an English football team, Liverpool Football Club. The disclaimer here is that is my own football team. And so it's, as you know, in the nicest sense, as a vanity project. But it's also a kind of an attempt to sort of shift away from East Germany to kind of broaden my sort of transnational approaches to football. So social cultural history of Liverpool Football Club is one project. And then I'm also working on various articles on East German football and East German sport, and in fact, German football and sport and their representations in popular culture, particularly in film and media. So that is also a sort of a longer term project as well. So hoping to my interest in football and continue to show its importance as a kind of marker of modern European social and cultural history.
Well, great. Those both sound like really interesting projects, and hopefully we'll have you back on New Books Network once your next book project is completed. But thank you again for giving us your time today.
My pleasure, Amanda. Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners for joining us once again for this podcast of the New Books in East European Studies. And we look forward to next month's interview as well.